Welcome back to Innovation on Dakota Midday. I'm Kara Hetland, and again, we're broadcasting from the 4850-foot level of the Sanford Underground Research Facility. And joining me now is Elizabeth Worster. Thanks for being here. Elizabeth is an experimental high-energy physicist at Brookhaven National Lab in Upton, New York, and she works on numerous experiments, but we'll start with the deep underground neutrino experiment. So thanks for being here, Elizabeth. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It's fun to have the chance to come underground again.
You don't come down often here?
We don't. We are not, at a scientific level, we're not building the experiment yet. We're more designing the experiment. So most of the work we do is computer simulations or with small prototype experiments. So we come here to tour, and but we don't necessarily do a lot of work down here on a day-to-day basis yet.
Yet, right?
That's right. Right? We will.
You'll get your fill down here at some point, right? So let's talk a little bit and describe, talk about the experiment. Give us a little tutorial as to what this is.
Okay, sure. So one of the really interesting properties of neutrinos that we want to study is something called neutrino oscillation. And what this means is that if you make a certain kind of neutrino and then you let it travel and you try to measure it again in another location, it might not be the same kind of neutrino anymore. It might have changed into another kind of neutrino. And so what we are going to do in Dune is we're going to make a beam of particles called muon neutrinos at Fermilab, which is outside of Chicago in Illinois. It's about 13...
Underground, right?
Well, this was close to at the surface, but okay. We will point the beam of neutrinos towards this location here, underground at SURF. So we're going to make these neutrinos called muon neutrinos at Fermilab, and they will travel through the Earth about 1,300 kilometers here to LEED, and then we're going to place another detector underground here, and we're going to measure the neutrinos again. And what will happen is that we won't measure the same number of muon neutrinos that we created. Some of them will have disappeared, and the reason they will have disappeared is they will have turned into another kind of neutrino. And so we'll measure the other kind of neutrino, electron neutrinos, and the exact details of how often that happens, what fraction of the time they've changed and what fraction of the time they've stayed muon neutrinos, will tell us a lot about the details of this kind of particle. And that can, in turn, answer important questions about, you know, all the way to the origins of the universe.
Okay, so for years, they tried to detect neutrinos underground here in this lab when it was a gold mine, right? And now you can create them?
We can create them, yes. So neutrinos can come from a number of different sources. The original Ray Davis experiment here at Homestake, which was so famous, was to detect neutrinos made in the sun. And neutrinos also come from cosmic rays. They come from supernova bursts. So when stars explode, they create large numbers of neutrinos that can be detected. But we can also create them on Earth. So Fermilab was originally an accelerator and is an accelerator complex. And so they can take protons, a type of elementary particle, and they can accelerate them to high energies. You take these particles and you slam them into, we call it a target, it's just a piece of material. You slam them on some piece of material and it makes a whole bunch of other particles. And these particles decay, and they can decay into neutrinos, among other things. And so if we manipulate the direction that the particles are pointing when they decay, we can end up with basically a beam of neutrinos. Everything else will stop in matter, but neutrinos can travel through huge amounts of matter without interacting. So these neutrinos will be able to make it all the way here to Homestake before they interact in our detector.
Hmm. It's fascinating, isn't it? And so talk a little bit about the big questions that you anticipate answering.
Okay, so one of the things that I'm really excited about is trying to understand differences between matter and antimatter. So antimatter is a thing. This is real. It's not science fiction. All particles can have antiparticles. And if a particle and an antiparticle come into contact, they annihilate and produce energy, just like in Star Trek, right? And so in the early universe, at the Big Bang, it's believed that the Big Bang should have created equal numbers of particles and antiparticles. And so an important question is, why are we even here at all? Why didn't they just all annihilate and leave nothing, just a big empty universe? And you know, that's not what happened. We're here and we're all made of matter. Everything that you see, the sun and the stars and the planets and us and your computer, everything, it's all made of matter. There's antimatter is only present in small quantities in scientific kind of experiments where we can make it and in certain kinds of small decays. But it's not what the world is made of. And so something happened early in the universe, right after the Big Bang, where all the antimatter went away and we're left with matter. And what we think happened is that, in fact, almost all of the matter and antimatter did annihilate. And everything that the universe is made of is just some tiny fraction of the matter that didn't annihilate with antimatter. There was just a little bit more matter than antimatter. And so when this annihilation happened, you were left with just this tiny fraction of matter, and that's what everything is made of. And so what we want to understand is, how could that asymmetry have happened? How did it come to be that there was this little bit more matter than antimatter? And one of the ways that we can get at that is for looking for differences between the way matter and antimatter behave. So when we make these neutrinos at Fermilab, we'll make some neutrinos and we'll also make some antineutrinos. And we'll measure the way the neutrinos oscillate, we'll measure the way the antineutrinos oscillate, and if we see some difference between this, this can be a step toward answering that question of how this matter-antimatter asymmetry in the universe came to be.
Okay, so talk a little bit about the building of this experiment.
Okay, so one of the things about neutrinos is that they interact very rarely. This is why they can pass through miles and miles and miles of Earth, and in fact, you know, light years of lead on average before they interact with matter at all. And so in order to see them, we have to have very massive detectors just to increase the chances of actually getting to see one interact with our matter. So what we're going to build underground here is 4 detectors, each of which has more than 10,000 tons of liquid argon. And so that material is what the neutrinos are going to interact with. So there's a huge amount of work beyond the scientific effort. You know, people like engineers and managers and mining experts and the people who were originally involved in the Homestake mine when it was a gold mine, all of these people have to work together to understand how to even excavate these huge caverns, how to get all the rock out, how to get all our detector components in. You know, when we came down here today, we came in a cage, it's called, but it's like a small elevator. And that's the only way down. So this massive detector that's, you know, bigger than a football field, bigger than an airplane, all the parts have to be small enough to fit in that elevator or hanging off the bottom of that elevator. So there's a lot of engineering and design to just figure out how we can get everything down here, put it all together, have it operate safely, you know, have it operate over very long periods of time. We expect this data, this experiment to take data over something like 20 or 30 years. So all the components have to keep working for that whole time. And then we take data at an enormous rate, something like terabytes per second of data have to come out of this underground area and up to be analyzed by physicists all over the world.
So the obviously the detector is going to be constructed down here. So the pieces will come down.
Yes, we'll build. It's going to be sort of a modular design. So the pieces will be built at the surface and then brought down, and then the whole thing will be put together underground because it's much, much too large to come down in any other way.
And how long will it take when the beam is ready and the detector here is ready? How long will it take for the neutrinos to pass from Fermi to here?
Oh, it's quite fast because they're very, very, very tiny. So they're moving close to the speed of light. So there's not a lot of time difference between when they're made and when we observe them here. But we have to take data over a very long period of time just to accumulate statistics because it's so rare for them to actually interact. So we are planning, you know, something like 20 years of collecting data before we're able to measure all these properties that we really want to measure.
And the interaction in liquid is a flash? Is that?
Well, it does create a flash, but there's other things too. So what happens is that when the neutrino interacts, it's a neutral particle. You can't see it. You can't really even detect it with the kind of detectors that we have. But when it interacts, it produces charged particles. It will produce a muon neutrino will produce a muon, which will then travel through our detector. And when it's a charged particle, can knock electrons out of their orbits. So you have all these, you know, you learned in high school chemistry, you have the nucleus at the center and you have electrons orbiting. and every atom is like that. And so when a charged particle passes through there, there's some chance that it can knock an electron out of its orbit. And so the detector is set up in such a way that as we knock these electrons out, they will move in an electric field and be collected on wires. And then those wires will turn this flow of electrons into electrical pulses. And then those electrical pulses will be turned into digital data that we can analyze with our computers. And so all of that process is pretty complicated, but it means that ultimately what we're going to reconstruct is the trajectories of charged particles within these detectors, and it'll look like a picture of different particles moving around. You can't ever see the particles, but you can see the tracks that they make, and so that's what we analyze.
And then, so how do you determine then how the neutrino has changed took off to when it hits the detector?
So each kind of neutrino, when it interacts, will make a different kind of charged particle. So if you have a muon neutrino, then it will make a muon. And we know a lot about how these particles behave in as they travel in matter. So the muon, we know, will make a long, relatively straight track. If it's an electron neutrino, which is one of the kinds it can turn into, then it makes a different kind of particle called an electron. And this electron, it doesn't make a long, straight track. It makes a big shower of particles. And so it physically looks different, the track that it makes in the detector. And so we can determine, based on sort of the topology of the event, whether it's a muon or an electron, and that will tell us whether it was a muon neutrino or an electron neutrino that made it. We can also, based on this same set of data, we can figure out the energy of all the particles coming out of the interaction, and that allows us to reconstruct the energy of the neutrino, which is another important quantity that we need to know for the analysis.
And so do you expect that the same ratio happening from when you send it to, so every time you send a beam, do you expect the same ratio of what they turn into, or do you expect to be surprised?
Oh, well, if it changed with time, we would be very, very surprised. We like to be surprised in physics. That would mean that there's something that we really don't understand. That particular one, I think, is expected to be rather unlikely.
Okay.
So the probability of it changing from the muon neutrino to the electron neutrino should depend on the distance, which in this case is fixed because we have the detector in one place and we made them in one place, and the energy of the particle. So different energy particles will have different probabilities. But that should be constant whether we do the experiment this year or next year or the year after that. And then there's this chance that it will be different for neutrinos and antineutrinos, and that's the thing that we're interested in finding out.
And what kinds of surprises are you anticipating? Where's your hypothesis?
So I think it is generally thought to be likely that this kind of matter and antimatter difference does exist. There are other long baseline experiments that are taking data now that are smaller and don't have the sensitivity that Dune will have, but that are starting to see hints that this may be happening. So we have some expectation that we will be able to see a difference between matter and antimatter. Now, the exact details of the particles that we observe in the far detector, the distribution of energies that they have, this can be altered by all different things. And so there's, what we always look for, we call it new physics, but it's anything that's not currently explained by our model. So we have a computer simulation that describes what we're expecting to see at the far detector. And, that can vary depending on the parameters that we're trying to measure. But we could see something that doesn't fit that model at all. And that would be very exciting. That would mean that there's some new thing, some new particle, some new force, something going on that is not understood by our current set of theories. And so that would be sort of the most exciting thing. Another thing that we hope we might be able to see that has never been seen before in this detector is actually not related to neutrinos, but the fact that we have a large detector deep underground allows us to look for proton decay. So protons are one of these elementary particles. They live a very long time, which is good for us because they make up our bodies. but there are some theories having to do with, again, origins of universe type questions that expect that they will decay at a very low rate, and this has never been seen. So every time you build a bigger detector, you're hoping maybe we can actually detect this. And that's one of the reasons we need to be underground, because in order to look for extremely rare processes like this, we have to make sure that nothing else could be causing that signal in the detector, which means we want to be shielded from anything that's coming in externally, including cosmic rays. At the surface, you have this enormous flux of particles coming through you all the time. Down here, we have all this rock over our heads, and so that rate is much lower, and it allows us to look for rare processes like proton decay.
Okay. And so how did you become so involved with this type of research?
Okay. So I guess I wanted to be a physicist from fairly early in my life. When I was, I always was drawn to science. And when I was a teenager, I read this famous book by Stephen Hawking called A Brief History of Time. And it was, you know, I was a good student. I was good in school. It was the first time that something was really hard for me. And that just blew my mind. I was so excited. I was like, I have to learn about this. And so I did, you know, I guess I did sort of a traditional path in a way. I went to college and majored in physics. I went to grad school and did a PhD in high energy physics. I worked on looking for matter antimatter asymmetries in another type of particle called kaons. So I have that as a sort of through line of my career, is looking for these matter antimatter asymmetries. And then about 5 years ago, I started working on neutrinos, and I work on an experiment called Diabay that measures a different kind of neutrino oscillation at nuclear reactors. And I've been involved for this time that I've worked on neutrinos in development of plans for this project, Dune, which has evolved quite a bit over the last few years. And the work that I do is really on the scientific side, trying to understand what we want to measure and what is required in order to get there to measure it, which drives all the technical details about how big the cavern needs to be and how much data we need to take and things like that.
Okay, Elizabeth, I want to thank you so much for coming on Innovation, and we plan on following this experiment for a very long time. So
great. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much.